And we're back. Another episode of Club 30. I'm doing great today. Jay, how do you feel?
I feel amazing. I am ready for this one. I'm pretty excited about this conversation.
This is a Olympian, iconic.
I mean, he's the greatest snowboarder of all time.
Like, imagine after the Olympics and they're like, cool. So the hockey player, the guy, right. Not the team or any other sports out there, this guy, yes. Here he is. So what's up on the ice? Do you like? Do you ever make snow cones? Yeah. Do you want to?
Can we shoot some pucks at
you? Yeah, we made you a snow cone over here. Won't you eat it? Yeah. Trying to navigate that was tough.
So talented and recently retired last year.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see how that transition is going for him.
Yeah. I mean, when I was growing up, I was a big skater. And then became a snowboarder afterwards. But guys like Tony Hawk and our guest today, they were just larger than life, you know, like these icons. And I'm really interested to, you know, they say never meet your heroes. I'm really interested to sit down today and hear all about this journey he's been on.
So let's do it. Let's not sit here and talk about it. Let's invite Shaun White, one of the greatest snowboarder of all time. He's won 3 Olympic golds in half pipe. Nobody has more career X Games medals than this guy. Welcome to Club 30 snowboard and skateboard legend Shaun White.
Yo,
welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
thanks
pleasure
for being here. So I want to know right away, I mean, you had so much success skateboarding, snowboarding at an early age. When did you start? Like, were you one of those kids that you skateboarded before you walked?
Yeah, I mean, I just remember skateboards being the first thing that was around. And I don't even think I stood on a skateboard. I was probably like on my knees pushing around one of those things. Like, it was a mode of transportation at that point. And it wasn't till they built this big skate park up the way from us. And I started going there. And then we started building little ramps in front of the house and in the community, little cul-de-sac that I lived in. But honestly, probably like three or four, I started like pushing around on a board, started skiing. And then probably 5 or 6 is when I started snowboarding for the first time.
Cool.
Yeah. So it was skate, then snow.
Well, I grew up in RS Sweden. I don't know if you've been there snowboarding, but I just struggle so much. Skateboarding, snowboarding, surfing. I need my feet to point in the direction I'm going.
How you're walking.
Yes, exactly. So for you, what is harder, skateboarding or snowboarding?
Oh, man. I think probably skateboarding, just because, the board's not attached to your feet. Right. And you have to be so precise. Like if the board flicks off your foot and just the slightest, wrong angle, the board flies away, it's over. But I always felt like that was the gift I was kind of given as a kid, where skateboarding gave my snowboarding the precision.
Yeah.
Because after a whole season of skateboarding, I'm like, wait, the board's just going to stay on my feet? Oh, what could be easier, you know? And so I got the precision from skateboarding to go to snowboarding, but snowboarding gave my skateboarding the size. Because the half pipes were like 22 feet tall. The jumps were like 90 feet. And you jump down to skateboarding, there's a 10-foot gap. And they're like, well, it's pretty big. I'm like, really?
Right.
So I had this kind of like beautiful sort of synergy within the sports. Nice. But I could always go from skateboarding to snowboarding really easily. But going from snowboarding to skating was a really hard. I had to relearn all my tricks. It's like a really weird sort of thing.
And just so people understand, like, how good you were as a kid. At 7, you were sponsored.
Yeah, yeah.
And you started winning competitions. Like, at what point do you realize, okay, I'm really good at this?
Yeah, I just think people kind of just took notice in our local mountain, at our local resort. I was just kind of the little kid that could turn and could be, I was fast, little jumps and stuff. And like, oh, he's, that people just kind of took notice. So I thought that was really cool. And then it wasn't till, like you mentioned, I was sponsored at 7. And that wasn't really out of me being the best on the mountain. It's just that they didn't make kids boards. That's how new the sport was. They're like, and it just so happened that Burton Snowboards was coming out with the kids line. And I was a kid in California. They're like, call the local rep. I ended up getting sponsored. And they're like, well, we should do some competitions. And so I entered the local events and it was a race. I was fast and I won. And now I'm like, wow, I can win something. And it just turned into this whole thing. But I got to say, it was my family. You know, my whole family started to snowboard. So it became our thing together.
Cool.
You know.
So how was that, being so good as a kid? Now you start showing up to these competitions, start beating guys that are much older than you. Like if that was in hockey, I would be pissed off, right? Yeah. This little kid is beating me.
Kind of like Bedard.
Yeah.
But how was that as a kid being so good competing against older guys?
Yeah, it was tough because I kind of found myself in a place where I wanted to be one of the boys. I wanted to hang, but I was so young that
nobody
I'm still traveling.
To hang with you.
Well, they were cool. They were, you know, like older brothers, but you know, we weren't like in the same, you know, tribe. I didn't feel like connected where I was running around with them, going out, doing fun stuff. I was with my mom, like learning algebra in the hotel room. You know what I mean? It was just a different thing. And competing with them was wild. I remember a bunch of events where I would win, but I couldn't get the prize because it was at a bar. And I wasn't 21, so I couldn't get in to get the trophy. They just kind of like opened the door and handed it to me. Like, oh, thanks. Like, all right, go have fun. You know what I mean? But it was cool. It was a fun time. And I remember always wanting to be taken seriously because I was so little that I was like, well, you know, the term kid points was getting thrown out a lot. Like, oh, you're getting extra points because you're a show. You got this act. And I was always like, I hate these kid points. I want to be taken seriously as like a true professional. And so that was kind of the hurdle to clear at that time for me.
But did you feel that respect from the other riders? The age gap must have been, 10 years?
Yeah,
sometimes?
Maybe more. Yeah, I went pro at 13 and everybody was in their mid to upper 20s. I remember hanging out and feeling like I knew they respected me in a way. And I knew that a lot of them felt like, because I was getting these nicknames like Future Boy and the whatever. And so I just knew that they knew I was coming for them. And they're like, okay, well, he's cute now. He's getting older. Here we go. And so I think they were supportive, you know, of my abilities and all that and knew how much work I'd put in. Because I was, every event, I was there, you know, pouring my guts out into the runs, into the training sessions, all that stuff. So.
And the family enabled that?
My mom and dad found this like rundown van that they used at the lookout points because we live in California on the border of Tijuana, and they had this like police sort of, I don't know what it was used for, but this old van that they found in the newspaper, and we ended up buying that, getting it refurbished, and then that became our mode of transport, and we would go to all these resorts for the competitions, and we just like camp out in the parking lot in the motorhome because it was really expensive to do. It's a pricey sport to you know, get lift tickets, to you know, stay at the lodge, to the food, everything, the equipment. And so that's how we made it work.
Cool.
Which is so wild to be at some of these. I became a part owner of Mammoth Mountain for a while, and I was like, I used to park in my van right over there. Yeah, that was my favorite tree. I used to use at night. Yeah, yeah, you know what I mean.
But what was the toughest part of being, you know, that young, up and coming? It makes me think of almost like a Disney star. You know, a kid that grows up and you became pretty famous early, right?
Yeah.
So, what was the big challenge for you?
Yeah.
If there was any.
No, for sure. I mean, that was hard to manage. I mean, at a certain point, you know, going to school became difficult just because they knew me from the X Games. I was traveling so much at the time that I didn't really have the ability to just like be home and have friends and go to birthday parties and do the normal sort of day-to-day life of a kid that age. Yeah. And then I remember with that kind of attention comes responsibility. Like, how do I conduct myself in my interviews? How am I seen in my photographs? And so it was a balance, a delicate balance of like being a normal kid, but also having, like, what was it? Miley Cyrus was Hannah Montana. She was a pop star, but then this normal kid, I think, was the plot of her show. But I was very similar.
Yeah.
I had this like star kind of career going on in the mountains, but where we lived in California, like no one really cared. They're like, you do what? And at that time, there's a lot of stereotypes that snowboarders were just burnouts. And so everybody thought my parents were just stoners and like, what do you do? and then all of a sudden I'm on TV, like, we're doing it. Because the sport at that time, you know, people didn't really care. You know, it was a pretty rebellious sport. Yeah. A lot of mountains didn't want snowboarders on the mountain. So for us to be like the first suburban family to be like, this is our thing, people didn't really get it. And so even through success, they're like, oh, that's cute, but we don't really understand. Once the sport actually started going mainstream and my career rise and the sport caught up, that's when things got pretty wild.
And when do you feel like that turning point was? I think back at 06, by the way, we share a Yeah, memories from 06 in Torino. Yeah. Gold.
Yeah.
Nice but for work. You, I remember that because it was a crazy run by you in the end, capturing the gold. Do you feel like that was kind of a turning point? Like people start to pay attention to snowboarding a lot more?
I think X Games really put snowboarding sort of on the map, along with skiing and other sports. But it was one of those things where I feel like big companies like Red Bull started to emerge. This sort of like action sports thing started to, because it started out in a very weird sort of place. X Games had like ice wall climbing and shovel races and downhill like snow mountain bike, like these weird obscure sports. Like carnival. Yeah, like let's see if they survive. And then the sports actually that, you know, had the communities built behind them, like skiing and snowboarding, those emerged and became the kind of focal point of those events. But it was pretty wild at the time. But I think probably X Games, and then what pushed things like way over the edge for me in my life was Torino. I went from being recognized once in a while, and in my community, I was a star. But, you know, you sit on a plane next to somebody and they're like, oh, you've won 15 X Games gold. That's cool. And you're like, oh no, but I have a gold medal from the Olympics.
And it's
like
a different conversation.
That you can understand that. It's tangible. So that really set things over the edge. And I had this huge red hair. Still kind of do. It's a little more fluffy today. But dude, I couldn't go anywhere. Yeah. It was nuts. Like walking through the airport, you just see me coming. And it was a wild time
in my
life.
It makes you understand, though, the impact of the Olympics.
Yeah.
Like to your point, like you've done so much X Games, but then once you win the Olympic gold, suddenly you have so many more eyeballs, so many more people are actually watching your sport. Mm-hmm. Same with hockey. I remember coming back and, you know, you have hockey fans, but you also have a lot of people that watch Olympics because of the pride of the nation.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they root for you because of that.
Yeah.
And it just, it's interesting to hear how, you know, how much it added to your fame, I guess.
And in your hometown, was that, I mean, you must have come home and it was just crazy for you, right?
We had a huge celebration in Stockholm, but then two days later, we had to be back in New York because the NHL season was going. But I remember even being in New York and people coming up talking about the Olympics, and it's just such a cool experience. Yeah.
But for me, there was never really a team component. It was just like an individual sport, like tennis or something. And then you show up at the Olympics and you're part of this team, and then you realize like, my medal at, I want to say the Korea Olympics in 2018 marked the 100th gold medal for the United States.
That's
and you forget
wild.
That tip. We were at 99. I popped us 200. So like, like you forget that that's, you become part of the history of the country. You know, it's like it's a deeper rooted thing. And I did always love that about the Olympics, that like showing up, you know, it's like, just going and becoming an Olympian, you're part of the history.
Totally. Can we rewind a sec?
Yeah, please.
Just your comment about your skill level and your success coincided with snowboarding becoming mainstream. I think a lot of people would argue that you're responsible for the other side of that too. But in your mind, who paved the way? Who were the people that fought from a, I don't know, like snowboarding was counterculture, but there was obviously some commercial minds that thought this thing has legs and it should be on the world stage.
I don't know. I mean, behind the scenes within the kind of the committees and whatnot, I mean, it's a lot of politics that actually get a sport into the Olympics. Sure. And I think there was just the need.
Yeah.
You know, the Winter Olympics, I don't know, and don't quote me on it, but I don't know how the viewership was at the time in certain sports, like the you know, the cross country skiing and shooting. Like, I don't know, it, you know, was more of a niche market at times. And so snowboarding and skiing freestyle was like a really big thing that was capturing the younger audience. And I know that's what the Olympics really wanted. And so I think that's why they kind of scooped it up and brought it in.
What about on the other side of the camera? What about athletes that
So athletes, I mean, there were a bunch of athletes along the way. I'd have to say Tony Hawk was probably the biggest name to come out of action sports. If you group them all together, it's Kelly Slater, Tony Hawk, myself. And then before me, I'm sure it was Terry Hawkinson, pro snowboarder out of Norway. There was a guy, Ross Powers. He won the Olympics. That was actually a really big deal, honestly. The 2002 Olympics, Ross Powers got first place. Danny Cass from New Jersey got second, and JJ Thomas out of Colorado got third. They swept the podium And in the history of the Olympics, that hadn't happened in so long, where the Americans just came in and dominated. And and so that was a really big deal in the press that really blew the sport out. But I know there's a lot of people that kind of paved the way. And then once I got in there, I followed their trail and then took it from there. But I do mention Tony Hawk because he was the first one to really like become a household name.
Sure.
I mean, it's Tony Hawk. He's his video game. You see him in commercials, all these things.
I had every one of his decks.
Yeah. And so I was at the time friends with him, and I got to be, you know, not necessarily like he took me and guided me into my career, but he was just going through everything I was about to go through. And I got to see how he interacted with his fans, how he dealt with the pressure, how he dealt with, you know, the situations. And it was really cool to have, you know, a mentor like that in my sphere of influence at the time.
No doubt. So. What about you, Hank? Anybody guide you through the kind of the how to act, how to behave, how to treat, how to find distance?
I think my twin brother, we kind of held our, you know, we looked at each other all the time. Hey, calm down now.
Like,
you might have a great game, but you always had someone to keep you grounded.
Yeah.
I feel like it's so important, obviously, to have a good crew around you and family first. But then I guess it's a little different. You touched on it earlier with team sport.
Yeah.
Like it's very different, I'm sure, being on your own and you're kind of your own boss, right?
Yeah,
but when you play team sports, it's like, it's the coach and you stand in line and work with your teammates, right? So I think that itself helps making sure you're staying grounded. But for you, I want to know, like coming back after the Olympics, was there like a moment when you realized, oh, this really changed now, like in terms of how people wanted a piece of you in a way, in the public eye?
Yeah, I think it was, I mean, it was wild. There's a moment that I talk about. I put out a documentary that's on HBO.
The Last Run?
Yeah, it's called The Last Run. I think for me, what was exciting was to reach a certain level of success within my sport because we didn't really have that. We didn't have the prime time slot. You know, tune in every time to see what we're doing, Super Bowl, you know, we didn't have that. And so to have the Olympics finally take that sport on and put us in the primetime viewing slot. And it was the first time that ratings had ever beaten American Idol. That was a really big deal. So, you know, but there's just millions and millions of people that watch. And so to come home, it was unbelievable to get the attention that I got. But not only that, but from talk shows, things like that. And the craziest thing happened where I'm finally asked to be on these huge talk shows and be in these magazines and do these things. And every single one that called was like, what stunt can you do?
Oh,
no they're way. Like, oh,
like
we want
to circus boy.
Yeah. We'll like slide you in on the stage. We'll throw a bucket of snow at you and you take your goggles off and you say, yeah, radical. You know, like it was always this thing. And I'm like, oh my God, like how do I? And so now I finally got that sort of level of success where I'm like, God, I'm being asked to do this. And I now have to say no.
Right.
Because I'm like, if I do that, I'm setting this template. I'm setting this precedent that I'm going to do this every time. Well, you did it for that show. Why won't you? And so I had to start saying no to all these things. And that's when I got, I think, very protective of how I was viewed in the media, because not only did I have the success and the recognition of the kind of world, but now I'm the face of a sport. You know, I was the guy and they're like, oh, this is, snowboarding. That's Sean. You know what I mean? And now I'm speaking for a group much bigger than myself. Like imagine after the Olympics and they're like, cool. So the hockey player, the guy,
right.
Not the team or any other sports out there, this guy, here he is.
So
what's up on the ice? Do you like, do you ever make snow cones? Do you want to?
Can we shoot some pucks at
you? Yeah, we made you a snow cone over here. Won't you eat it? Trying to navigate that was tough.
And do you feel like the work you did on behalf of the snowboarding community was appreciated?
I don't know. I think it's a mixed bag because it's tough. I think people really enjoy the sport for the rebellious sort of rock and roll, like tattoo, smoking weed, going out, partying, like that culture is still embedded in the sport. And I think some people hold on to, I don't want change.
Yeah.
And then a lot of people were really embracing of the way I handled it. Cause I'm like, look, I'm not going to do a stunt, but I'll show up in a suit. I'll be funny. And we'll talk about the thing. You play the clip like any other guest. I'll shake your hand. I'll walk off. And that really kind of, I hoped usher our sport into a place of legitimacy.
Totally.
Where people are like, oh, I take it serious. And I had some people come up to me that had their whole lives in the industry, and guy went home for Thanksgiving and he's talking to his family and they're like, so do you work with that guy, Sean White? And he's like, yeah, I do all the time. They're like, oh, no way. He's like, for the longest time in my family, I've been considered a burnout and that I don't have a real job and I haven't amounted to anything. And you gave legitimacy to my right. life with my family. And that's such an awesome gift. So there are those stories where I go, okay, I think yeah. I'm on the right track. But yeah.
It's funny. You talk about this. I look at my notes. My next question was like, to me, you're not a snowboarder.
Yeah.
To me, you are snowboarding.
Yeah. It's a heavy crown to wear, right?
Yeah. It must. But you look at everything you accomplished. Like, I'm sure there must have been some moments that was tough as well, mm-hmm. right? Was there any moments throughout your career where you kind of just felt challenged in the way the love for the sport because it was so much?
Yeah. I mean, I think at a certain point, I was just kind of doing everything because I wanted to. I was so excited to take on new projects. And you're no longer like hoping to get a deal with this brand. You can just call them up and be like, I want to work with you. And they're like, oh, great. Hmm. Well, we love that. You know what I mean? So I started doing like a lot of different deals, a lot of different things. And I just, you know, the more things you do, the more service days and the more practice that you got to try to make up for. And, you know, orchestrating this whole thing just became a lot. And so I think around the Olympics in Sochi, I just kind of burnt out in a way. I lost a bit of that fight. And I was not only doing the half pipe, but then they're like, well, such a success having snowboarding in the Olympics. Right. Let's add slope style, which is the series of jumps and rails and a run. And I, at that time, I probably had more slope style medals. It was just not in the Olympics. Yeah. And so I would take a break every 2 years, do the half pipe, go back to slope style. And this year I'm like, perfect. Double gold. Here we go. And I got this going. I got that going. I got a documentary. I was playing music in a band. I was doing all this stuff. And I got there and it just was too much. And I had lost something. You know, I lost that Olympics. I didn't podium at either discipline. And so I got home and I was like, man, I need to take some inventory. And all this stuff that I went to correct in my life had nothing to do with snowboarding. It was like, I got to reconnect with this friend that I haven't spoken to in forever. And like, you know, my brother, he's been a huge supporter in my life and career. He became travel companion, team manager, artists. He was my photographer. He was everything. I wanted to reconnect with him. And it's like all these little things weighing on me. And then I just became like a happier person in general.
Yeah.
Then once I was back on the board, I'm like, okay,
yeah,
I'm back. But that was a really difficult time for me because I was just crushing it. And then you lose and you go, wow, well, what now?
I'm going to rewind it just one more second again, because you guys have something else in common.
Yeah.
And you made me think of it when we were talking about kind of mindset and finding gratitude and realizing that the sun comes up the next day, but you guys have both had open heart surgery.
Oh, no way.
Hank a lot more recently than Sean, I think.
Hey, yeah. Welcome to the club.
It's a great club.
Yeah. Wow. Well,
But I was curious, when you went through that moment, did you do it by yourself? Did you have help? Did you find somebody to talk to?
I think a mixture.
Yeah.
I mean, I started doing therapy, which was something I was like, nah, I'm good. I'm an athlete. You got to just tough it out. When it gets hard, you got to just bury the feelings and push through. You know what I mean? I was from that sort of mindset. It's a lot more openly talked about nowadays about the feelings that you're going through and the pressures and those things. Back then, for me, it was just like, I just got to grind it out. And I'd hit that point where I needed something. I was like, okay. And so I started doing therapy, and that really helped me kind of understand that it wasn't just me having these weird thoughts. Like, no, I understand. I get you that if I were in your shoes, I understand. I'd feel the same, or, you know, or hearing from other athletes talk about their ups and downs really helped. And then I went to, later on in life, I went to a Tony Robbins event, and that actually did a lot for me. I really loved what he's all about and just the teachings of his stuff. I don't think it's rocket science. It just gets you in a place where you're open-minded enough to consider looking at life in a different way, in a way of like, oh, wait, maybe it's me.
Maybe I don't know everything.
Yeah, I don't know everything. Maybe I'm not perfect. Yeah. Maybe I'm not, you know, weird, and you start to understand yourself and your relationships. And yeah, it's just really cool, and it enables you to communicate your feelings. And so I think a lot of that really helped me later on in life. But, you know, that big upset, that for me was like, I needed help. I needed to talk to people. And, you know, it was friends, family, and then, yeah, therapy for sure.
What made you think, like, I needed somebody to talk to?
Well, I was already talking to someone. Mm-hmm. So when it did happen, obviously it was a shock, but I was in such a good place mentally. I was so happy. It was disappointing when I got the news that instead of going to training camp, I have to go and have the surgery and probably end my career. I didn't know it at the time, but it was strange how calm I was. Like I was just thinking about it as another challenge, another game. Okay, I need to just get through
here
this.
We go.
But the fact that I already worked on myself before I, you know, faced that challenge, I think made a huge difference. Like I've already been working on, you know, focusing more on, towards gratitude and finding happiness in so many different things in life and things that were around me. So I felt like I was just, it was almost like when I started to work on myself, it was almost like it prepared me for that news.
Interesting.
Because when it happened, I was like, okay. I was sad, no question about it, but I realized pretty quickly, like, okay, life is good. I'm going to get through this. And then I was so happy after surgery and grateful and had a,
did you ever feel like, I mean, at least for me, I remember thinking at the time, if I were to do therapy or were to do these things, it would be like admitting this sort of weakness or admitting that I wasn't enough or I, you know, needed help and I just wasn't my bag at all. And I think what was the wildest thing is that afterwards I felt like way more empowered. I was like, oh, okay. Like I've been to the Olympics. I've won. I've been to the Olympics. I've lost. I've crossed this bridge. I've seen what's on the other side. And if I'm going back in now, win or lose, I'm good.
Right.
And I felt more dangerous than ever. I was like, okay, here we go. And it's a bumpy road to get to that next Olympics for the career games. But yeah, I just felt so empowered. I don't know if you felt that way or like you said, you're going in for heart surgery. You're like, I feel pretty good. That just isn't normal. It's not like a lot of people.
I remember the surgeon said, I had never seen someone be so calm going in for an open heart surgery. But no, I think being a goalie too, the mind was so important, like how I focused, how I prepared. So it's always been part of my career, talking to someone.
Yeah.
A lot of times, obviously, you talk about your game, but you also talk about your life and make sure your mind is in the right place. So you can actually focus on the game.
Right.
But I think there's no question that there was more focus on my sport than on me as a person, my first 10, 15 years when I was talking to people. And obviously I talked to my goalie coach a lot, but I also had a coach guiding me a little bit. But I always felt so refreshed every time, you know, you're done with the session and it's like a lot of the issues you think you have, you're just creating them yourself.
So, because snowboarding was my outlet.
Yeah.
For turmoil or certain things or whatever, I was like, oh, I just got to go pop this podium and we're good. You know what I mean? Like, oh, like
kick everything else in. Push like, all those other emotions.
They're like, oh, how do you deal with this? I'm like, no, this was my outlet for the stuff happening in a normal life. So that's why you could see at times like I'd be doing really well, but behind the scenes, I wouldn't be as thrilled at times or, you know, you got certain things and you realize that winning doesn't exactly get you.
Yeah, I don't think winning
you're
looking
builds for every time, you know.
Winning doesn't really build resiliency, right? There's no comeback from if you won every single Olympic gold.
Man, I was on my way. I was
you're close.
Everything was going great and then you get that upset and it teaches you some things and somebody said you don't as people we don't grow from the good times, we grow from the hard times and once you kind of take that and go, "Oh, well this is a hard time coming my way." I'm going to grow from this in some way or another, you know, whether this sent you back on ice or in a different direction, you grew in a one way or the other. And I just think that's such a cool way to look at it.
Right? That's the thing. Like you talked about the joy, bringing the joy back. Mm-hmm. Like I remember playing, sometimes I start to feel the pressure and like I could stand on the ice. And I try to remind myself, like I play this game because it's so much fun.
Oh yeah.
And like telling myself like the reason why I'm here is not really to play at Madison Square Garden. It's actually because I love this sport so much and it's so much fun. So you bring back that joy and not, you know, think about the pressure, expectations. And then you just you calm down.
Yeah, it takes practice to get to that
practice.
Place.
Yeah, it takes practice. Absolutely it does.
Yeah.
But so what was going through your mind before you dropped?
Before I dropped?
You know, you looked at it. Yeah. Every time I see it up close, I can't believe like how steep it is and big it is.
Well, if you see me up there and I'm joking with you,
That's good.
That's a good. That's not good for you. But yeah, you know, I mean, like, oh, hey, man, I was like, that just, I'm just so calm. I'm so good. And I'm in the space and like having fun. And then something happens because I know this about myself, but like once I'm put in the start gate, it doesn't really even happen until I'm in the gate and this happens. And it's like, here's the run. Everything kind of falls away. And that's all that there is. It's the half pipe and the tricks. And when I'm at the top, obviously, I think running through my head is like, certain doubts, certain things like that. But right when I get in the gate, they all just kind of go away. Mm. And I have a few things. I mean, I think, you know, advice for athletes or anybody that's trying to overcome something, just kind of find a pattern. For me, it was like, okay, I don't watch any of the runs. Don't care. I don't want to see them. I'm off riding the mountain. I'm like, call me when I got like five to go. And they're like, oh, hey, somebody crashed. We got a delay. And so I show up, they wax the board, and I'm like, okay, cool. We got like three or four people to go. The third person in line, I put one binding in. Second person goes, I put the next binding in. Last person to go before I drop, I watch that run. It's the only run I watch. And then I sit there thinking the same thing every time. Like, if they make the run, I'm like, well, who are they? Like, if he made it, I can make, you know what I mean? I just build it into this thing. And then if they fall, I'm like, oh. There's blood in the water. You know what I mean? Like the judges, the last thing they saw was this person crashing. And if I can come through and crush it, like, you know, I don't, whatever it is, it's just a hype thing. And then a lot of times you can tell them to play certain songs at the top. And dude, the power of music, when you're standing there and you have doubts in your mind or any insecurities and they just kick into like, whatever, Back in Black, AC/DC, you know, whatever I chose, you can't do the ballads. You need something that comes out the gate because you only have a certain amount of time. But dude, your song comes on, you're like, man, it's the theme track to my life right now. I'm like, this might just be my moment, you know? And then everything kind of falls away. But I feel like there's a delicate balance of being completely focused. And then I don't know if you feel this way, but like kind of not caring.
I was pretty intense. So to me, it's very strange. Like, but obviously I had teammates be very loose. Everybody has a different way of finding their peak. For me, I was like, I didn't talk much. I was kind of in myself.
Okay, okay.
But then I had teammates that were complete opposite.
Yeah.
But I understand what you're saying, like finding that balance of not putting too much pressure on yourself, but still you need to keep your focus, right? But how much did you stick to your, did you have your game plan set or could you change during the run? Okay, I'm going to do this now instead of what I thought I was going to do.
No, it happened just before. I'd pick the run before. There's rarities where like I made a mistake during the run and then went, oh my goodness, I made this blunder. I need to like take this last trick that I was going to do that was a 900. Now it needs to be a double 1080 or something like that. Mm-hmm. Something that you wouldn't normally see in a qualifying run, but I know that I did a mistake at the top. Now I got to make up for it at the bottom. But most of the time you're standing there, you kind of clock what's happening. And even though I don't watch, my coach is there watching. He's like, oh, these people fell. So-and-so tried this. He'll just give me the breakdown of what happened. And then I have like two or three runs planned and we can kind of alternate depending on what's happened before my run. And then how I'm feeling, like has the clouds rolled in? Has it started snowing? Is it windy? Is it like, okay, well, maybe we back it off a little and then the next run we step it up. But yeah, I always had that thing. But I think the focus is like, I always describe it as like if you played ping pong with somebody and you're like point after point, you're winning. And then all of a sudden you take notice, like I'm up in points. And then you start trying to play with strategy and whatever, and you start losing points because you took a mental notice of like, oh, I'm in the lead. I'm doing well. And then you start making mistakes because you're overly focusing. So that's why I say you got to kind of not care. You got to kind of just let it happen and be in that moment.
Have we seen your best run or have you had this incredible run in practice that nobody ever seen?
Good question. I'm not sure. When I won the Olympics in Vancouver, I had shown up. I won the competition with my first run. And it was your best run out of two. So I'm standing at the top. No one beat my score. I'd won and I got what's called the victory lap because I had one more run to go still. I knew I already won. And I was like, look, I've been practicing this trick. It's called the double McTwist 1260. And so for people listening, McTwist is basically describing a front flip. And the degrees of rotation are exactly that. Those are the numbers. So 180, half a circle, 360, 540, 720, 900, 1080. So you keep going up. And so this is a double. So it's a double McTwist. So it's two flips. So two front flips while doing 1260.
On the
so
other axis.
It's a lot. Yeah, yeah, off axis spinning. It's a lot happening. At this point, people had just started doing the double flips, something I invented in the half pipe, and doing a double flip 1080 or doing a 900, that was a really big deal. And this was a 1260. And so it was a big, big moment for me. I drop in, I do the run, and I nail it. The only thing that would compare to that run was the winning run in Korea. I was at the top of the half pipe. I'm the last rider to go for my final run, and I'm in second place. And the trick that I had to do in the run previously put me in the hospital. I did the trick in New Zealand. I threw it wrong. I clipped the top, bounced to the bottom, and I ended up cutting my face open and bruising my lungs. I had 62 stitches in my face. It was a horrible, horrible thing. What do they call it? A warning. If you do watch the documentary on Max, there's a pretty graphic shot of that injury. But fast forward to the Olympics, I hadn't really done that trick in a run. And I'm there. I have to do it in order to win. And I was like, all right, well, now or never. You know what I mean? And I'm making my way through the run. First hit, here it comes, second hit. And it just was perfect. It just happened. It just was like there for me.
Huh.
I nailed it. And I'd never done that run before in order to win the thing. So that, I think, hands down, when I look back at my career, it'd be those two runs. But for sure, that Korean performance was just like, I don't know, hands down.
Cool.
Yeah.
I mean, you decide to retire at 22, so last year.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a difficult decision?
It was, yeah. I mean, I think I knew this day would come. I think I was more just tripping out that, like, wow, I talked about this as a kid. They're like, you know, you can't do this forever. And I'm like, oh, yeah, we'll see. Yeah. Catch you later. And then there it was. I was like, wow, okay, I have to, you know, make this difficult decision. I think I realized a couple things. I don't know how it was for yourself, but for me, I got to decide. So many athletes I talked to, they're like, dude, I was called into a room. And they're like, hey, look, it's over.
You're right.
And you're like, what? And they're like, yeah, or either you're traded or like contract's over. Like,
yeah.
You don't decide. And that's a horrible thing to be left with where you're thinking, I didn't get to give it all. Mm. And for me, I knew that, like many athletes, you strive to hit a certain height. You know, you want the cup, you want the ring, you want the whatever. Like, I had hit that top a few times. So it's not like I'd never reached that pinnacle sort of thing. And I just had to listen to my like body and my heart to say, like, am I truly in it, you know, still in the way that I was when I was younger? Cause it can be dangerous if you're not fully in. And I had to make that tough call. But the moment I decided to retire, everything after that was just so great. It was just this beautiful sort of like, oh, this is the last time I'm going to do this. Everything had this little sparkle to it. I was like, oh man, this is the last time I'll be here.
Yep.
Stressed out about whatever run I'm about to do. Oh, this is the last time I have to like run out and get my bib and do the, like, right. Every little thing had this sort of fun to it. Cause things that would be a drag, I'm like, well, it is a drag, but this is the last time I have to do it, you know? And so I don't know, everything had this special moment to it. And being at the Olympics was so cool. I mean, a lot of the competitors that were there, I remember, you know, normally there's this kind of, there's tension.
Sure.
And I, you know, you're competing with each other. Everybody wants to win and you're looking over and I just remember these kids just smiling. I was like, what are you, what? And they're like, dude, we're huge fans. I'm like, what? No, is this how this works?
Shit.
Supposed to be, you know, angry about it.
Yeah.
Kids these days, you gotta learn something. Yeah, I was like, damn it. They're like, we played your video game. You know, like, okay. So, you know, it was cool just to see, I guess, the ripple effect of my career. And they're like, dude, I've watched your videos and that's what got me into the sport. And now I'm here competing with you at the games. This is the craziest thing. And so I felt really, you know, humbled and happy with my career and everything that had happened. And even not to hit the podium at that last event, it was just like, you know what? Like, this is a celebration of the whole sort of run of my snowboarding career. And yeah, so I was happy. It was definitely a tough call to make though.
Mm. Do you call it a retirement? I like transition.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
It's more of a transition than retirement, right? Because there's so much left to do. And you're busy, you know,
I've almost never been busier. Like, it's just a different way, know? And
what takes up the most of your time right now?
Yeah, well, I launched a brand and the name White Space is obviously playing my last name, but the term is for a blank canvas. You know, it's a gap in the market, a void, waiting for something new to be created. And I love that when you think about the sport, because the sport's one of the only sports where you can go invent a new trick and be the best in the world. There's a lot of artistry to it. Uh-huh. Obviously, there's, you know, ways to get the goal, but there's we're inventing new moves and new things all the time. You have your own style, your own thing. And so I love that with the meaning of the sport. So yeah, that's been taking up a bunch of my time, which is fun. And we've talked about, we actually have a few people on the program, but like, man, we're sponsoring young kids similar to how I was. Cool. And helping their careers now. And so it's just really fun, warming. I'm like checking in, like, how did they do at nationals? I'm like, I want to know what's going on. And it's just, it's like being in the sport, but just in a different way. And of course, like anybody doing a business, like I'd love for the business to be successful. That means we can continue on with the business. But I think the thing that does it for me is, you know, you spend so much time making something. You know, I test all the products. That's my role. You know, I'm like, it's got to be good. I know my stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so when you see somebody on your board, I it's just such a cool connection. I'm like, I made that. And the customer, you know, they were out there, and there's such a sea of products available for people. And they stood in front of that wall of stuff and saw your item. I'm like, that's dope. And that best represents what I'm about and what I think and how I want to ride, and they take it out and enjoy themselves. And so yeah, it's a really fun sort of cool connection.
Do you think you'll stay in touch with the sport for the rest of your life?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like I said, that's my way of escape from everything else is to go ride, to go surf, to go skate. I mean, it's just kind of a product of where I was, you know, where I grew up. You know, we had skateboarding nearby, surfing nearby. Actually, snow is the furthest thing from where I grew up, in San Diego, California. But yeah, there's something about the sport. I've kind of just gone back to the basics of riding with friends, finding fun things to do. And now I have this brand that I can like lean on, and it's fun to be still involved in the sport, just in a different way.
That's awesome.
You know,
we got Hank back on skis last season.
Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up skiing, but I didn't ski for like 25 years. And then last year I picked it up finally. Okay. And I just love it.
Funny, because I thought Scandinavia, you're just born with skis on your feet, right?
Yeah, like, but because of hockey, it was too big of a risk to, you know, we have a 3-day break. I'm not going to go ski and blow a knee.
But the mechanics of skiing and skating are pretty
similar.
Yeah. Maybe not as much of the pushing and getting the momentum, but
were really
stopping,
sharp,
right?
So I like when you know, I have a strong edge.
Good edge,
yeah. So that was something that I had to adjust to. But it was quick. A couple runs, and it was almost like riding the bike, right?
Well, I got to say my skating is pretty terrible. It's pretty bad. I would do these contests up in Vermont, and they're like big hockey, you know, players up there. And you know, some of the kids, they couldn't really take me on the mountain, but man, when I was on the ice, I was fair game. Just checking in the wall and bounced off the, you know, boards. And man, it was fun though. I do enjoy it, getting on the ice when I can.
It sounds like the transition from competing to now still be involved with the sport, it sounds like you're in a really good place.
Yeah, no, it's been good. I mean, it's definitely, I will admit though, because it's, you know, in all fairness, like it hasn't been just like, oh, I'll jump from this to that. This is something that's carried me, in the common thread that's carried through my life as long as I can remember. So kind of cutting a piece of that away has been really difficult. Like showing up at the mountain and not having a particular reason, it's been tough. I didn't realize how much enjoyment I got out of that.
The singularity, you know, of the focus?
Being at the mountain with a purpose. I'm here to learn this trick so that I can hopefully win this event that will qualify me for that. And then if I win that, then there was always something next. And so for me to be there without that thread is like, and what's funny is I remember retiring thinking like, oh, I don't have to deal with that sort of anxiety and pressure and those things that come along with that. So you kind of step away for one reason, but realize like, oh, I kind of miss the pressure. I miss the need to do certain things in that purpose. So I'll say I'm finding my way, but that is something I've been kind of struggling with recently.
It's interesting.
Like, I totally understand. That's the one thing I say.
Yeah.
Guys are asking me like, what do you miss the most? And it's exactly that.
Yeah.
The pressure, expectations. And to your point,
yeah,
when you were in, it's like, oh, it's tough to deal with this.
Yeah.
But now you realize you crave that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? Well, I think you'll get this because I know you play guitar, but something about like not having a team and having a sport that is enjoyable on your own is a really cool thing. So like I could understand why a Tom Brady would want to come back out of retirement all of a sudden and be like, whoa, I'm not ready for this, because where can you get the same fulfillment? Like you, even the taste of it, is he going to go do a pickup game at the local park?
Or, right.
You know, what? Like, yeah, you know, if you're going to go play hockey, it's like, okay, cool. Yeah, I get some buddies together maybe, or like got to orchestrate all this stuff. At least like I can pick up the guitar and jam, or mm-hmm. I can pick up the board and go ride. Like
yeah.
It feels good to just like enjoy the sport. And that way I can still work on tricks if I want. I can do whatever. Obviously it doesn't have the same shimmer on it as it used to, but I still get to enjoy it. So I do feel fortunate in that way.
Do you obviously can't wait and lift lines very effectively. For that
No, but, man, in the heyday, I mean, even now I got so much gear on, it's hard to tell who I am,
sure.
But they had to get me like a special pass to get through because they're like, well, you just hold up the line. Yeah. Cause I'd be standing there and they're like, oh, let's get up. Ah, and then everybody, like the lines kind of start moving
it's
in.
It's like
and
kid soccer. Like, just
yeah. They're the like ball. Here. And it was like the pass, but then there was like a laminate of the like, you know, manager, resort manager's business card on it that says like, let him through. And I'm like, here, you can either call the head of the resort or you just let me through. You know,
it's hilarious.
Maybe not everybody would get the word that I was coming through, but I had all these funny, yeah.
Is that one of the reasons why you cut your hair? I mean, that would be easy to spot with your big curly hair.
The hair was a funny one, man. So I was actually in Las Vegas and I ran into a guy named Carrot Top. I don't know if you know Carrot Top.
Yeah,
he's like old comedian.
Yeah.
Huge red hair. If you're a redhead with long hair at the time, they'd
that
be
was
like,
your nickname.
Oh, Carrot Top. Right. Yeah. So yeah. I was thrilled to meet him. Funny guy. And I was like, we need a photo so that people know that we don't look alike at all.
Right.
And so we did this photo and I kind of leaned in. I'm like, oh man, I'm thinking about cutting my hair. And he was just like, what? And he's like, do it. You have to do it. And it got really serious. He's like, no, do it. He's like, I'm stuck like this, man. This is it. This is my look. Not that I don't think he doesn't like how he looks, but that's just been his thing for so long that he's stuck that way. And I always describe it as meeting like the ghost of Christmas future. He's like, there's still time for you. And I was like, oh my God. So I went home like, oh, I can change my future. So I like
amazing.
Went home, I cut the hair, and I had found out that there was a charity that takes the hair and they make wigs for kids undergoing certain illnesses. And so I was like, oh, it's a great cause, this thing. And I just went and did it. But yeah, that's where the hair went.
That's awesome.
I think
Vegas.
It's got to be. Yeah, Vegas. Go to Vegas, you that come sounds, home and I got no hair.
That sounds like a likely story.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I love it. I just want to say, huge fan of your career. Incredible what you've done for the sport of snowboarding. And honored to have you here at Club 30. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. That was awesome.
Yeah, of course.
Thanks
you guys.
For hanging.
Great
awesome.
To have you here.
Yeah. Good times. You.
Thank you to Sean for joining us today at Club 30. That was awesome. Wow, he's impressive. And I'm happy to hear that he's, you know, the transition is going well. It's not easy to, you know, after being, he plays such a big part of snowboard. But obviously that must be a challenging decision to decide to walk away.
Especially when your body can still do it. He's still at the top of the sport, still had a ton of earning potential, you know, in the sport. It's a hard decision, but you know, like the biggest void is right after retirement when you are getting ready to compete, like you're, you know, pre-game, that feel, it's impossible to replace with anything else, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's going to come down to, you know, making sure you have fun and do things that you care about and interest you, right?
Yeah, because memory's selective. You don't think about the cost associated with all the preparation hours and all the training hours. You think about the outcomes of all of those prep hours, the competition.
Kind of surprised me a little bit when he was talking about what he missed. He looks like a chill guy, right?
Yeah.
And having a lot of fun even when he was competing,
mm-hmm.
but he missed the pressure.
Yeah.
I did not expect that.
Yeah.
Like the, you know, but probably that's what made him so good.
Right.
You know, he thrived.
There's a couple of points in there, our chat, where he gave us little clues as to like what a killer he is competitively.
you know, like blood in the water. And just when I said, when he said, you know, if you see me up at the top before we drop into the half pipe and I'm really relaxed, and I said something like, oh, that's a good thing. He's like, well, it wouldn't be good for you. You know?
Yeah.
It seems like he's out for blood when he competes, and he really brings everything to, you know, just training and qualifying, but competition's a whole nother level for him where he thrives.
Well, as I really enjoyed it. It was awesome to have him here. Yeah. And
what great energy. It's so fun.
Well, listen, I hope you guys really enjoy this show today. And we'll be back next week with another guest.
If you like the show, we'd love to have you as Club 30 members. So hit that subscribe button and hit that thumbs up button.
See you guys.